Okay. So now, with the introduction that we gave last time, we're going to start the piece of Talmud that deals with the specifically with the seven laws of Noah. All right. Now, let's just first start the Talmud itself and raise the questions which occur to us naturally, and then I'll discuss with you some of the general principles and particular concepts involved. Okay. Now we're starting at on 56A at the bottom in the Babylonian edition. In the Aramaic, it is two lines from the bottom. In English, I imagine it will be a little more because English is a wordy language. So it should say the rabbis have stated, or am I right? The rabbis have stated seven laws were commanded to the sons of Noah. If you have that part of the Tractate of Sanhedrin, 56a on the bottom, okay? All right, now let's just first read a little bit of the Talmud and then we'll decipher it. All right, seven laws were commanded to the sons of Noah. And then it tells you the seven. All right? First one is that it mentions is the law of setting up courts of law. The second one it mentions is blasphemy, okay? The third one is idolatry. The fourth is the prohibition against certain sexual encounters. And the fifth is the prohibition against murder. The sixth is prohibition against theft. And the seventh is the prohibition against consuming, eating the limb of an animal that was taken from that animal during its lifetime. Okay. That statement so far doesn't pose any problem. But now we continue, and the Talmud states, Rabbi Hananya, the son of Gamliel, says, also with regard to blood of the living. Now, this means that there's a prohibition, another prohibition, that a Ben Noach is not permitted to drink the blood that was taken from an animal during its lifetime. Okay, this is not the same thing as a prohibition of drinking blood, because if the animal died and then the blood was taken from it, then there would not, in essence, be any violation. Okay, the violation is blood that is taken from the animal during its lifetime, which means while the animal's alive, if you would go and you would take a pint of blood out of the animal, you would be prohibited to drink, to consume that blood. Okay, let's go a little further. Now, Rabbi Hidka says that there's a prohibition for the Ben Noah even on castration. That means to destroy the procreative organs of a of any animal. Okay, that also is a prohibition. Then we have Rabbi Simon says there is even a prohibition on magic and sorcery. All right, and then we have Rabbi Josi says, he comments that whatever is stated, every prohibition that's stated in the chapter on magic and sorcery, every Ben Noah is also enjoined to refrain from. Okay, all right. Let's just stop here for a moment. What we have is a what we have at present, without going any further, is the question which must be in the minds of all of those listening. And that is, first we start off with seven, then we add eight, the one with regard to the blood, and then we add with regard to the destruction of the organs of the animal that have to do with procreation. Then we have the prohibition on sorcery. Well, I mean, we're adding already ten. And then we even have another one later where it says that a Ben Noah is not permitted to crossbreed animals, okay, or to crossbreed trees. Okay, so it comes that we start off with 7, but then we wind up with 10 or 11. Now, how does this work? Someone that takes a look at the Talmud says, this is very puzzling. This is not a, this doesn't seem to be very organized work. Numerically, it's they say 7, and then we wind up with 11. Okay, how do we approach this type of a question? What do we do with this type of question in Talmud? And the answer is that, you see, whenever you have an argument, a debate between the Talmudic scholars, and this is of fundamental importance, what it means is that there is a nucleus that was received from Sinai. The 7 laws of Noah were received from Sinai. Now, there, what happened was that throughout the generations, so some things were lost. Some facts were lost. And wherever facts were lost, the halacha does not come to a standstill. Because then the Torah would never be workable today as it was in the days of Moses. So God, in his infinite wisdom, gave man a method to function and a way of operating and working, even if he should lose part of the system. Now, the way that that works is simply that a person who is a very great scholar has the right and the ability to formulate theories. And according to his formulation, according to his theoretical understanding, he has a right to answer questions that arise. Now, there really is no difference between a question, let's say, for instance, we have modern-day technologies. With the modern-day technologies, halacha is confronted with new problems that it never had before. How do we work with them? Well, what do we do? Well, the answer is that this is not a new thing. This is, has already been given at Sinai. When God gave the Torah at Sinai, he didn't give a system that's going to come to a dead halt if certain things are forgotten, or that's going to come to a dead halt if new things are discovered and invented, because God knew that this would happen. So what God did in the Torah is he gave the people of the Torah, he gave man a way of working out these problems. And the way that it's worked out is very simple. It's the same way that a person works when he studies physics or mathematics or any area of knowledge. And that is, if a person studies an area of knowledge, he must of necessity become involved in what we call theories. Now, once a person has a theory always has certain results, whether it's a theory in math or whether it's a theory in science, or whether it's a theory in halacha. Now, when you have a theory, so then according to theory A, then we should do X. According to theory B, we should do Y. So the way that the system of Torah works is that there is the theoretical part of Torah. In the theoretical part of Torah, a scholar has a right. Not every individual has a right to do this. I mean, a person who's an ignoramus, his theories are worthless. Just like a person who's an ignoramus in medicine, his theories are worthless in medicine and physics or any science. In order for your theory to have any value, you have to be a scholar in the field. And the same thing is true of Torah. Unfortunately, in Torah, everybody considers themselves a scholar, but such is not the case. So the method, getting back to the point I'm making, the method of analysis and the method of the continuity of Torah is based upon this most important principle, namely that the Torah is a theoretical work. So therefore, when a person studies all the facts that are available to him in Torah, if he knows all those facts, and if he has a great mind and he's a good theoretician, he has a right to set up theories and function and work according to his theories. That's why you have so many arguments in the Talmud. When you see an argument in the Talmud, what it means is simply that a piece of information has been lost, okay? And because of that, there is room for speculation and theory. I don't like to use the word speculation, because speculation sounds like just idle Speculative sounds like anything that comes to a person's mind. But the theories in the Talmud are of a certain type, and they have a specific form to them. But the point is, again, the main point is that when we find that a piece of information is missing, so then we have the scholars come and come along, and they give their theories. Now, this is true today. It's been true in the time of the Talmud. It's true throughout, from the time of Moses, when Moses debated with Aaron about eating, whether she did a certain sacrifice, or whether the daughters of Tzelophehad raised the question to Moses, and they debated their point with him. Debate and theory has been part of the Torah system from the day of its inception. So it's nothing new. And it's really the beauty of Torah, and as I've said many times, those of you who have read Psalms know how King David speaks about the great beauty of Torah. He's speaking about the theoretical aspect of Torah. Okay, so getting back to this point, what we have to do when we come to a piece of Talmud such as this, we raise the question. Question is, we said there's seven, but now we find there are many more than seven. What do we do with this? So what we have to do, first of all, is to ask another question. Did the scholars of the Talmud, who, you have to remember, that the information that the Talmud had was received from generation to generation, going all the way back to the giving of the Torah at Sinai. So it's a long time. Now what we have to try to do whenever we see an argument, what we have to try to do is to find out what does everyone agree about and what do they argue on. And now notice in the Talmud, there isn't just wild argumentation. For instance, there's no one here that says, there's no such thing as the seven laws of Noah. No position like that in the Talmud. Because this, we know that there are laws for the entire family, for the entire humanity. So, there's no question there. So you see that this piece of information, the reason why nobody argues about that is because that piece of information was known by all. That was carried down accurately. What we have to ask in this case is, does everybody agree that there are seven laws? Or maybe this itself is a debatable point. Maybe some held there were seven, others held there were 11. Okay? In order to go any further at this point, what we have to find out is, and in every argument, what you have to try to discover is, what are they not arguing about, and what is the common point that everybody agrees on? Then, once we discover that, then we can discover what the argumentation is about. Okay? Is that clear? Is that logical? The way you study a piece of Talmud is, when you see an argument, what you have to do is, first of all, find out what everybody agrees upon. Then, if you know that, then you can understand. Then you can begin to understand or to unravel what the theoretics are involved. Okay, so our question here is simply, was it carried down from Sinai to the scholars of the Talmud? Did they have this information that there were only seven laws, or is that itself a debatable point? Okay, so the last time we studied together, I suggested that you read through the Talmud that deals with this area, and I said read through about a page or so. We will now make recourse to the information that's found further in this on this page. Okay. Now,
Rabbi.
Yes.
I think maybe something that we should look at in the beginning, you talked about the sages and the oral tradition coming down to the Second Temple period. What is the earliest known sources of the seven laws of Noah?
The earliest known sources. All the sources that we have state that the seven laws of Noah were given at Sinai. Not a single scholar throughout the generations ever argued that point. In every generation, there were those that were in charge of keeping the corpus of the oral law. Moses gave it over to Joshua to the elders.
Okay.
And there is no... The point I'm trying to make is that there is no doubt that this piece of information, that the seven laws of Noah were given at Sinai, no one argues with that point. So there is no, so it is quite clear that this point was carried down without any question from Sinai.
Okay, the point that I would make is that obviously this was in existence prior to Sinai.
Oh yes, that's true also.
And so what is the, are there any ancient sources other than the oral tradition that dates it back? You know, we know that some have said that Adam kept five of the Sheva Mitzvot.
Oh, we're going to get to that.
Okay, all right. And so this, I think this is the foundation. So, all right, if you're going to get there, I'll just drop out then.
Okay, because we're going to get the Talmud. We'll discuss that later.
Okay, all right, that's fine.
In other words, everybody's in agreement that it goes back to Noah. But does it go back to Adam? We'll see that that's a, that, that is not,
right.
That we don't have information about. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So the important thing to remember when studying Talmud is many people, you know, are people who are looking for a certain kind of religious security are always disappointed in Talmud because they see arguments and they want to know that what they're doing, this is exactly what God wants me to do. Well, in our religion, we don't say that. We don't say this is exactly what God wants us to do. We say God wants you to use your intelligence, your mind, and understanding and do that. That's what you're supposed to do. Okay? In that respect, our religion differs from any other religion. And that's why you have all the arguments. So the arguments which give certain people insecurities really should give a person the greatest security. Why? Because you see that the debates of the scholars are never about the most basic issues. Now, why don't they argue that? The answer is because it's obvious that they had carried down without any question that information. They're only going to argue where the information is lacking. So you can tell from an argument what information they had for certain and what information they didn't have, and then they go into theoretics. But that is the way the Torah works. Without theoretics, you would have no Torah. Because you understand very well, as soon as a piece of information is lost, that would mean it's lost forever. So that's why Torah could not survive without theoretics. But besides that, without theoretics, you wouldn't have any beauty of Torah. That's the whole beauty of Torah is theoretics. So it's important to realize, and I think this is one of the criticisms that people always make against Talmud. They say, well, the rabbis always argue. That's true, but look at what they argue. They will argue only certain points. Nobody, for instance, argues that you slaughter an animal by stabbing it in the belly. Nobody says that. Why don't they argue that? They argue every other point. And the reason is because that was carried down from Sinai, that there is no doubt about that piece of information, that the slaughtering must be done on the underside of the neck. So there's no question about that. So the argumentation, rather than throwing a person into insecurity, really proves the point that you see that the arguments of the Talmud are restricted to certain areas. They're restricted to a certain radius, which shows that they had certain definite information which no one would argue about, which is proof of the Mesorah, of the what we call in English, I hate to use the word tradition, because tradition doesn't really mean intellectual knowledge. Tradition means something which is based on the fact that people just did things. I don't like to use that word. But it gives evidence to the fact that there was information that was carefully carried down from Sinai. Okay, so getting back to our text of the Talmud, the question that we have to raise here is, was the information from Sinai intact in the time of the Talmud, in the time of the people that are discussing these laws over here, in their time, was there information to the effect that there were seven laws or not? Okay. Now, for that, let's make recourse to another piece of Talmud, which is found on 56b. All right? So, the Talmud states as follows. Talmud states that there was a Tana, which means a scholar of the Mishnaic period, and he said that you take out out of the seven, remove two, and he put two other ones in. Which were the two that he removed? He removed, one of them that he removed was the law of the courts. He says that's not part of the seven. And the second one he removed was blasphemy. And instead, he inserted two other ones. One was the castration of animals, all right? And the second one is the crossbreeding, okay? So this person, he took out two, and he inserted two other ones. And the Talmud states that Debei Menashe states that seven mitzvahs were commanded to the children of Noah, and he gives his list, and instead of having the one about the courts, the legal system, the establishing of the legal system, he takes that out, and he also takes out the one about blasphemy, and he inserts instead one about the castrating animals and the crossbreeding, okay? Okay. Now, what do we see from that Talmudic, from that little piece of Talmud? We see that there was carried down from Sinai a numerical value of seven. Because here we see that this individual who disagreed with the rest of the scholars, he said, take out these two and insert other two instead. Now, why does he do that? In order to keep the number seven constant. So we see that from the piece of Talmud following later, which we're not going to analyze right now as to the theory behind that. We'll get to that a little later. But, by the way, that happens to be a practical, a very practical issue. According to, if we maintain that there is a prohibition against, destroying the procreative organs of an animal, then a person is not permitted to fix his dog or his cat. A non-Jew would not be permitted to do that as well. Ben Noach would not be permitted as well. And we'll see later that there are people that maintain that that prohibition is, in fact, existing today. But I don't want to right now get into the final practical halacha. All right, that's a, we will, but let's first get into the Talmudics first, and then we'll have a better understanding. So getting back to the point, this point, we see from the way that Talmud explains later that there was an opinion that took out two and inserted two others, you see from that type of a formulation that why did he take out two and insert two others? The reason is he's trying to keep the number seven constant. So from this we can deduce that the number seven was actually carried down to the Talmudic scholars, and they had an accurate record of the fact that it must be seven. Okay, and you must remember that the scholars from the time of Moses kept written records of the oral law as well. They just were not published. They were not permitted to be published. But they, for themselves, privately, they always kept written records. Okay. The reason why they didn't allow it to be publicized is simply because of the fact that that is a law that you're not allowed to write down the oral law and have it publicized at large. And the reason is, Maimonides explains, because then anyone that gets a hold of it will simply read one part of it and they'll think he understands it, they'll think he's a great theoretician, and they'll misinterpret it, which is what happens today all the time. Whenever I read these articles on which quote Talmud, it's amazing how people have no concept of what the study of Talmud is, and as a natural result, they misinterpret it. So today, we can't do anything about it, but we have to live with it. But originally, the only ones that had access to the oral law were the ones who were the scholars, and they only permitted scholars to have access to it. Now, let's get back to this point then in the Talmud. So we see the number seven is definitely something which was carried down from Sinai. Now, then we have to come back to our little piece of Talmud. According to our part of Talmud in the beginning, it states that there were seven, and then we have these other opinions that say even blood, okay, even the castration of animals, and then we have sorcery, okay. So how can we have? And then we also have the prohibition against the crossbreeding, okay. Now how is that possible? So let us take a look at each one separately. All right, there is one. One answer we can give when we take a look at the first one. I think everyone will probably think of this answer. Let's take a look at each one individually. The first one is that Rabbi Hananya stated, even on blood, okay, blood from the living. Now, there we could simply say that Rabbi Hananya is not adding something new to the seven. He is simply saying that that is included in the violation of removing a limb from an animal and consuming it. In other words, what he is saying is he's not adding number eight. He's saying that with regard to what you mentioned before, in other words, with regard to the prohibition of taking a limb from an animal and consuming it, that doesn't just include the limb, but it includes blood also. Whereas the first position maintained, no, it does not include blood. It only includes the flesh of the limb. Okay? So here we don't encounter the problem with the number, because we've established from the further part, from the text a little further, that they did consider, that the Talmudic scholars did have number seven. If they had number seven, so the question was, how could you add number eight? And the answer is, it's not an addition. Rabbi Hananya is not adding anything. He is simply saying, I want to make this point clear, I disagree with the previous statement, which only mentions the flesh of the animal. I say the blood is also included. Okay? So now what we have to do is, we have an argument, a Talmudic dispute. And we have to see what are the theoretics behind this dispute. We're going to take them, as I said before, we're going to take them one at a time. So let's forget about the ones that come later. Let's just deal with this one, with the blood of the living animal, blood taken from the living animal. Okay, so now how do we approach this? We have an argument among the scholars. One scholar says that the blood is permissible. If you take the animal during its lifetime and you should remove a pint of blood, then you could drink it. The other states, no, this is a prohibition which is included in the under the law under the violation of consuming the limb of an animal. Now, how do we begin to approach this? I mean, we could just start with some speculation, but that's not the proper way. The way we have to approach this is, we have to see what other information is contained in the oral law. You have to realize that every scholar in the Talmud, when he discusses one area, knew the entire Talmud. Okay? They're at a very great advantage over us, because we are studying this portion of the Talmud, but we don't know the whole Talmud. Okay? But everyone who was a scholar knew every Mishnah and all the interpretations on their fingertips. So here they're discussing this little portion, but meantime their theories are coming from the vast knowledge that they have. Okay, so what we have to do is do a little investigation with regard to halachic investigation with regard to this area of the blood of the animal, and we can start off with a logical question. The logical question is, would you say that the blood of the animal should be included under this prohibition or not? What would you say about that? Now, it's not enough just to say what you would say, yes or no, but you have to also be able to support it with some kind of a theory or understanding. Now, on the surface, I would think that most people would say, well, yes, because what's the difference between the blood and between the flesh? This is all part of the animal. Okay. Now, then, if that's the case, if that is true, then, of course, the conclusion is correct. But what we have to do is we have to seek through our Talmudic sources to see if that conclusion is correct. Okay? So what do? So we go to the area of the Torah that deals with the prohibition of blood, and we raise a question. Is the prohibition of blood a separate prohibition, or is blood prohibited because it's a part, a component of the animal itself? It is the animal. Okay? Now, of course, you'll ask me the question, well, how am I going to discover this? Because since the Torah prohibited blood, here, in order to understand the seven laws of Noah, we have to go to the laws, to the 613, because the concepts are always going to be consistent. You're not going to have different concepts.
Rabbi, okay. We've got to turn the tape.
Okay. Turn
All right, if you want to finish your point, then I would like to ask a question in relation to that. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so now what we're doing is we're doing a little investigating. Now, what is the prohibition of blood in the 613? Now, in the 613, you have a definite prohibition of blood in Leviticus where it says you shall not consume the blood, and the blood is the life of the animal, which is biologically true, of course. The blood is the thing that supplies the very life of the animal. The heart is really just a pump, and it pumps the blood around. The blood is what does all the work for and keeps all the cells alive, supplying oxygen, taking away poisons, etc., etc. So the Torah makes this point that the blood is the lifeline of the animal, and you're not permitted to drink the blood. However, this point is made for a Ben Israel, not for a Ben Noah. Now, the question we're raising is the blood considered a part of the animal, or does this come under a separate prohibition? Because if it comes under a separate prohibition, so then it's not considered part of the animal. Okay? And if it's not considered part of the animals, then when we go back to the law, to the Noahide law, where you say you shouldn't take a limb of an animal, it wouldn't include the blood because the blood is not a part of the animal. So we have to discover whether blood is considered a part of the animal or not. Okay. Now, fortunately, we have a way of discovering this because, as I said before, at first sight you'd say, well, you cannot discover this because there is a violation against blood anyways. So maybe it is part of the animal, but then there could be another violation added to it. You'll ask me a question, well, why would it be necessary to add another violation? The answer is because it is a more serious sin to consume the blood of, let's say, for instance, a non-kosher animal. If one consumes a non-kosher animal, his violation is not as severe as if he consumes the blood of the non-kosher animal. Again, in the case of the kosher animal. If the animal is kosher, so then the Ben Israel can eat the animal. If blood is part of the animal, he'd be able to drink the blood. So you must have a violation for blood. There's no question about that. But now our question is blood considered part of the animal or not? Now there's a way, fortunately there is a way to discover this. And that is from the case, a specific case, and that case is, I'm using Maimonides' approach, and that case is the case of human flesh. Question is one permitted to consume human flesh? Of course, one is not permitted to kill another human being, but let us say, for instance, you had the case recently where these survivors in the Andes, their fellow men died, and they consumed their flesh. Would that be a Torah violation? Now, the answer is that even for a Ben Israel, even under the system of the 613, okay, there is no negative commandment against eating human flesh. Nachmanides maintains that there is no positive commandment either. However, we're going with Maimonides' view, as I said before. Maimonides maintains that there is a positive commandment against consuming human flesh. In other words, by positive commandment, it says as follows, because the Bible says, this you shall eat, and it points to the various species. So Maimonides says that this means to the exclusion of everything else, and it's to the exclusion of a human being. Okay? So according to Maimonides, a human being is prohibited for a Ben Israel. He cannot consume the flesh of a human being, of the dead, unless, of course, it's a matter of survival, then he could do anything. But if it's not a matter of survival, he's not allowed to consume the flesh of a human. Now, however, with regard to the blood of a human being, Maimonides states quite clearly that blood does not come under any Torah violation. So, from the formulation of Maimonides, it is quite clear that blood is not considered a component, a part of the animal. Okay? Now, if it were part of the object itself, so then you could not differentiate, in the case of a human being, between his blood and between his flesh. Because when you say human being, you'd mean everything that's part of that organism. But you see that the blood, according to Halacha, has a separate status, and it's not considered as the flesh itself. Okay, that being the case, let's take that information and now come back to our piece of the Talmud. Now, with that information, we see that we would side with which position based upon that information? We would side with the position that the that the blood would be permissible, because just like with regard to all other animals, not only man, but with regard to all other animals, actually, blood requires a separate prohibition. It's not included generally. It's not considered part of the organism, so an organism can be prohibited, but the blood could be permissible, as in the case of a human being. That being the case, we would have to side with the position that maintains that blood is permissible in the case of the Ben Noah, where he removes a if he should remove blood from the animal during its lifetime, it would not come under that prohibition. Okay? So that would explain the side. You see, what we try to do in understanding a Talmudic debate is we try to understand one side at a time. That would explain clearly the side that states that blood is permissible, does not come under the prohibition. Now, if you remember, that's a little bit counterintuitive, because when I raised the question before, I'm sure everybody would say, well, blood has to be prohibited as well. But we see that our intuition in areas where we don't have any knowledge is not really too reliable. So the same thing is true in Talmud, that our intuition is not based on the knowledge of the facts, so therefore we just go into an emotional intuition. Emotional intuition is not very helpful when it comes to studying a science or an area of knowledge. So, again, in this case, when you take a look at the information, you find that blood is classified as a separate substance. Since it's a separate substance, it would not be included in the prohibition of against eating the limb of the animal. The limb of the animal would mean only its flesh. It would not mean its blood. Okay? So we understand the side that maintains the blood is permissible. I'm going to stop right here in order to give David a chance to raise a question.
Well, I think that maybe we need to just go let you finish before I pose any, because I've got a couple of questions on that would go back to the very foundation. I'm sure you're going to deal with it. For instance, I would say how God gave animals. If I'm not to eat the limb of a living creature, how do I eat an animal?
Okay, I'm going to get into that.
Yeah, that's what I figured. And then what about the blood? It says here that Rabbi Gamliel said not to partake the blood drawn from a living animal, but what about the blood from a dead animal? And you're probably going to deal with that, too.
Well, the blood from a dead animal is definitely not under the prohibition. There's no question about that.
Okay.
There's no question about that. Okay, we're going to get into a little later. We'll get into the question of a dead animal. But the dead animal does not come under the prohibition. If the animal dies, but I want you to understand something. When I say if the animal dies, it means if the animal dies before the limb is removed. If the limb is removed first, even if the animal subsequently dies, it will not make that limb permissible. In other words, once the object is prohibited, it will always remain permanently prohibited. So it doesn't matter whether the animal dies later. But if the animal dies first and then the limb is removed, then there is no prohibition. Okay, so let me just move along. Now, what I would like to do is, in order to explain the other side, what I'd like to do is go to a case which is perhaps perhaps a bit unusual in halacha, but it is a case where the Ben Noach's law is more severe than the Ben Israel. Now, ordinarily, this is not the case. As you understand, there are 613 laws for the Ben Israel, and there are seven, or 25, 30, whatever, for the Ben Noach. Okay. I'm not going to give an exact number. There are various opinions on that. But there are certainly the basic seven. Okay, the basic seven. Now, the question is, the point I want to make is there is a case where the law for the Ben Noach is more severe than the law for the Ben Israel. And I'll give you the case. Let us say, for instance, an animal is being slaughtered. Now, ritual slaughter, according to halacha, is a very quick, sharp incision with a super sharp knife that doesn't even have a nick in it that's discernible to the human senses. So this slaughter is what makes the animal permissible. In other words, the moment the animal is slaughtered, then it is permissible to eat the flesh. Now, there is a question. The question is as follows. Sometimes, even after an animal is slaughtered, there is a moment where it might still be breathing. It might still be gasping. Now, if that should happen, the question is, theoretical question, would one be permitted to, if one would remove a piece of flesh at that time, is that permissible or not? Okay. Now, you have to understand this, the question is purely a theoretical one. It's not because anybody wants to do this, but we have to understand the law. So we have to understand the law. We must know all the ramifications. Now, therefore, we raise every possible question. So the question is, if one would remove flesh after the slaughtering process takes place, but while the animal is still visibly moving, would that piece of flesh be permissible or not? And the answer is like this. For the Ben Israel, it's permissible. For the Ben Noah, it's not. Question is why? And the reason is that for the Ben Noah, it would be the removal of flesh during the animal's lifetime. Whereas for the Ben Israel, since for him the slaughtering is what makes it permissible, not the dying, so if there should be a moment between slaughtering and death, it doesn't make any difference, because the moment the act of slaughtering takes place, since according he has a certain halachic reality of slaughtering, and since the moment that slaughtering takes place, the animal is permissible for the Ben Israel, because slaughtering is a halachic institution which gives the permit for eating for the Ben Israel. So in the Ben Israel system, this animal has already had the required permit. Okay? Now, however, let's take a look at the Ben Noah system. The Ben Noah system is that the permit is death. So therefore, since the animal is still alive, it still is breathing, there's that fraction of a moment where it might still be alive, so then the Ben Noah would not be permitted to eat the flesh that was removed during that moment. Because for the Ben Noah, the permit is death, not slaughtering. In other words, for the Ben Noah, slaughtering is not an institution which gives him a permit. It is the death that gives him the permit. Now, it is theoretically possible in certain cases, rare cases, but it is possible for the animal to be alive after slaughtering and for a moment or so, and then it will die. So the flesh removed during that moment is precisely would be prohibited for the Ben Noah, and it would be permissible for the Ben Israel. That's one of the rare cases in halacha where the Ben Noah's law is more severe than the Ben Israel's. Practically always it's the reverse. But this case, because of the logical formulation of what is the permit insofar as the Ben Israel is concerned, and what is the permit insofar as the Ben Noah is concerned, because of that logical formulation, you can have a case where the Ben Noah will be prohibited to eat the flesh, and to eat the meat, and the Ben Israel will be permitted. Okay? All right. Now, I brought that case in order to bring up a point. My point is this. The question that we could raise is, when the Torah prohibited the limb from the...
Rabbi?
Yes.
We need a point of clarification.
Okay,
this is from the peanut gallery.
Go ahead.
Does animal mean only land type? Fish or mammals out of H2O move, but once out of their domain, are they dead? Is it same for Ben Israel and Ben Noah?
That's the same for Ben Israel and Ben Noah. That the removal of the the removal of the limb from an animal does not relate to every creature. It is specifically for the land animal and a land animal, which would mean the domesticated animal, the wild animal, and the birds. Okay? But it does not apply to fish. The law does not apply to fish. It's an interesting thing. Now that you mention that, I'll bring up another point. That with regard to fish, the blood of fish is viewed differently than the blood of an animal. As we said before, the blood of an animal is considered as a separate component, whereas the blood of fish is really considered part of the fish itself. Okay? So you have to know which animals you're discussing. The higher animals are viewed differently than the lower animals. Okay, so the law of the prohibition is only for the higher animals, not for the lower ones. Now, getting back to this point, the reason why I brought up this case is because right now we could raise a theoretical question. And the question is as follows. The question is, when the Torah said that you're not allowed to take the limb of an animal that was removed during its lifetime and eat it, what, for the Ben Noah, what does that mean? Is that a specific restriction? Or does it mean that an animal is not permitted to be consumed at all? There is no permit to partake of the animal until it dies. Okay? You can construe it in two ways. It could be a very specific law, in which case what you're saying is that the limb of the animal that is removed from the animal during its lifetime is prohibited. That's one way to make the statement, to formulate the law. The other way is simply that death is the permit, that death is what makes the organism permissible to eat. Before death, you cannot partake of that organism. Two possible formulas. Now, here is where the theoretical question exists. Now, if we say that the prohibition is against the limb of the animal in specific, so then we would say it is a prohibition against the flesh of the animal, because, as we said before, blood is considered something different. But if we say that death is the permit which allows man to partake of the organism, then it would be inclusive of everything in the organism, which would include the blood as well. Okay? So we have two possible concepts here when we approach this prohibition of the limb which is removed from the animal. Is the concept that it's a prohibition against the limb? If that be the case, then we would have to equate it with all other prohibitions in the Torah, which are in the 613, which, when these prohibitions are formulated, they're formulated with regard to flesh separately, with regard to blood separately. Okay? But there's another way to construe it. We can understand it to mean simply that every animal for the Ben Noah must, in order to consume that organism, you must have the permit of death. Death, when death takes place, it's a halachic permit to consume that organism. If that is the theory, if that is the formula, then you understand that would be inclusive of everything that is included in the organism, which would include the blood as well, not just the flesh. Okay? So we have two ways of viewing it, according to halacha. And that is why we have this debate between these scholars. Because one view was that the prohibition is very specific against the removal of the limb. That being the case, it wouldn't include the blood, because blood requires a separate formula. The second position was, no, it's not a specific against removal of a limb. The law is that an organism, until it dies, is prohibited. The moment of death is the moment which makes everything permissible. So if that's the case, if a person would take blood during the lifetime of the animal, that would also be a prohibition, because you are removing part of the organism before it died. Nothing is permitted until you have that event of death. The event, the death event makes that organism permissible. That's basically the law of removing the limb. According to that view, it's not a law against, not a prohibition against eating a limb. It's a prohibition against, the prohibition is that death is the permit. You cannot consume any part of that organism until you have that permit of the event of death. So the event of death is a halachic permit. Now, if that's the case, if it's a halachic permit, it would be a halachic permit on everything that is part of the animal as well. So therefore, the blood would be included in the prohibition. So here we have two different views of the scholars. And these are two theoretical positions. You could formulate it either way, and either way will be completely consistent with all the other information that we have from the oral law. And it's a matter of which theory the particular scholar considers to be the correct one. Now, we don't know. The Talmud doesn't go into the mind of each scholar. So we can't know what prompted each one to believe that his theory is the correct one. But what we do know is that there is no information that would contradict either one of these theories. So each scholar has the right to function according to his opinion, to state his opinion and to function according to his opinion. Until they get together and they at a court and they take a vote on it, then it's a different story. But before that time, each one has a right to follow his opinion. So here we've explained this argument between these two scholars. That explains that one addition. But it also removes the problem of how come the opinion that maintains that blood is prohibited is not considered as if it's an eighth commandment. And the reason for that is, as we've explained before, because he maintains that the entire organism is prohibited until you have an event of death. So according to him, that's really part and parcel of the law of removing a limb. According to him, it's not the idea of removing the limb. The idea is the death event never took place, which would make an organism permissible. And if the organism is not permissible, any part of the organism is prohibited, which would include the blood as well. Okay, let me just see if there are any questions at this point. I mean, this session I know has been a very theoretical one. So if there are any questions, I'll be glad to answer them.
I think everyone is pretty much with you. I don't see any hands going up.
Okay.
I don't know if you're going to deal with this later, and if you are, you can. But you've talked a lot about the dying animal and the dead animal, but you haven't determined precisely when the animal dies as far as the non-Jew is concerned. You did for Ben Israel, but you didn't for Ben Noach.
Okay, the death, according to the for the Ben Noah, it would be the moment that the breathing in the heart stops. Okay, it's the moment that there's no more heartbeat and there's no more breathing. That would be the death according to for the Ben Noah. This of course involves a very big question when in halacha when it comes to today's advances in medicine. What is the death? When is the death of a human being? If you put a human being on a heart and lung machine, so then they keep on breathing, and they could be brain dead, but they will still keep on breathing. And if the definition is based upon breathing, so then the person is still alive. But that is a completely separate issue. With animals, we don't put them on a heart and lung machine, so we don't have this kind of a problem. So death means the moment it stops breathing and there's no heartbeat. Now let's just go a little bit further in the Talmud, and let's take the next question. Okay, next question is Rabbi Chitke says, even on destroying the organs of procreation in an animal. Now the question is, where did this come from? Okay. There is another one that I'm going to skip over the next one about sorcery, because sorcery, again, I think you'll be able to answer sorcery yourself. The question is, how could Rabbi Simon say even sorcery? All right, and the reason is very simple, because obviously, according to Rabbi Simon, the sorcery is an extension of idolatry. All sorcery, all magic, anything at all which causes a person to believe in any force besides God, any non-material force besides God, say a spiritual kind of force, is idolatry. So we understand very well that all these things that are prohibited in the Torah, the sorcery and the whole list of things that are mentioned in the Bible, all those things are basically extensions of idolatry, and they come from the same emotional source that idolatry comes from. With regard to idolatry, the Torah has set certain limits, and the question would be, is the Ben Noah involved? Are his limits the same as the Ben Israel, or are his limits different? That's really the question here among the scholars. So the prevailing opinion is that the Ben Noah is limited to the major violation of idolatry, which means actually setting up an idol and worshiping it, a physical form and worshiping it. But if he does magic and sorcery, philosophically, of course, he's removed from God. He's on a low level. But that is not one of the seven. And if I would ask you again, which opinion would you side with? So at first glance, you'd say, well, of course, the opinion that includes all those other things as well. Because let's face it, the sorcery, magic, and all those things are basically the same emotional source as idolatry. You believe in a different force, different kinds of mysterious supernatural forces. So why should the Ben Noah have a greater leeway with regard to that? I mean, that's a normal question to raise. We would say, if just like the Ben Israel is prohibited from all forms of idolatry, even minor ones, so too should the Ben Noah. But the answer to that question is, if you recall, we explained...
Rabbi,
yes.
You got, and I'm serious this time, about 1 minute.
Okay, I'll take it.
Okay.
Okay. If you remember, the seven laws are really one entity. And the violation of any of those laws, the reason why there's a death penalty for any of those laws is because that is the most basic system which entitles a human being to live. So therefore, the other scholar maintains, it cannot be included in a basic system. It's true that it's wrong, but you cannot give a person a death penalty because he followed magic. It's wrong, but it's not part of the basic system. So those are the two sides with regard to magic and sorcery. And we'll continue with regard to the other ones.